This is Art in Focus, brought to you by the McMullen Museum of Art at Boston College. My name is Nisha Momin, class of 2021 and a McMullen Student Ambassador. I'd like to welcome you in listening to the first episode in a series on the exhibition, Taking Shape, Abstraction from the Arab World, 1950s to 1980s. This episode is part two in a two-part interview with the co-curator of the exhibition, Suhaila Takesh and Sultan Sud Al-Qasimi, the Barjeel Art Foundation founder and a visiting instructor in Boston College's Islamic Civilization and Societies program. They will be interviewed by Atta Chowdhury, a McMullen student ambassador and member of the BC class of 21. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I know that the Barjeel collection does have a lot of art by female artists, and so we wanted to sort of touch upon how Taking Shape plays a role in amplifying women's voices. And Sultan, you can also touch about just in the collection how the process of acquiring art from women and just like reaching out to them and collecting it, like how that process was.
Yes, so this is actually one of my favorite parts about working with Barjeel now, which is to expand the presence of art by women in the collection. It is as though I discovered a whole new world, which was unknown to me, where even as a collector, I've been buying for almost 20 years, and I wasn't aware of most of the women artists that I'm aware of today. And so if you think of Syria or Morocco, I wasn't aware of any women artists just a few years ago. Even in many of the Gulf states, I wasn't aware of many women artists, but I was pleasantly surprised, especially in the last 3-4 years when I started digging, is to discover all these women who are very active. And I can give you an example of one of them, Minhat Helmi, who is very popular now in the collection. We have two works by her. Initially, I put out a call on social media and I said, I'm looking for modern women artists in Egypt and in the region. And then this Sudanese woman replied to me and said, when I lived in Egypt in the 1990s, there was a nice artist who lived on the floor above me, and I met her on the stairwell, and this is her daughter's number. And so her daughter had, the woman had passed away since, and the daughter moved to Canada. And so I call her up and I say, I'm interested in seeing works by your mom. She sent me an email. And then turns out that not only was her mother making interesting art, her mother was a pioneer. Her mother won a Slade Prize in 1965, the first prize at the Slade School for etching. Her mother went and represented Egypt in the 1950s and 60s in the Ljubljana Festival and in São Paulo and in so many other festivals around the world. And she was also thinking about women representation, and she was thinking about space exploration, and she was thinking about, you know, not only the present, but also the future. And so it was very important for us to sort of include her in the collection because, again, she had suffered from ill health because of working in the studio in close proximity to paint, and she wasn't able to work any longer. And so by the 1980s and 90s, she sort of started being forgotten as a pioneer artist. And so this is part of the resurrection of the recognition of these women artists. We keep discovering women artists even from the 1930s, like Khadija Riaz in Egypt, which is a new discovery for me, only from a few months ago. And then there was an artist in Tunisia who was doing art in the 1930s, a woman artist. But for me, you cannot underrepresent 50% of the population. And there was an issue with women artists, which was that they were not, as a collector, they were not represented by galleries as often. Why? Because the male artists were the ones that were recognized. Galleries would show more male artists. Governments would support more male artists. And the collectors would end up buying more male artists. The publishing industry would publish books about male artists. And so what we decided with Suhaila about 2 years ago is from now on, in the space that we control, the space that we manage, which is the Sharjah Art Museum space, that we would only be showing 50-50, 50% female, 50% male artists. And this is our second exhibition there that we are working on now. And Suhaila is, I think, just unveiling this week, in which women will be represented in equal parts with men. And one last thing I'll say, and I know that I've been going on and on, is that when we initially started talking about equal female representation, a lot of people were skeptical, and Suhaila can elaborate on why that was the case. But I'm so happy that even the skeptics that went to visit the show after the changeover, after it went from being 75 or 80% male and 25, 30% female, I asked them, did you feel that the quality of the exhibition suffered because of this, the parity in the showcase? And none of them said yes. Everyone said no, we feel like the works are equally strong. And maybe I'll ask Suhaila to elaborate on why there was the skepticism.
Yeah, you know, this question of women representation is a very interesting one, right? I mean, definitely women are underrepresented in mainstream global art history, as are all kinds of, you know, different minorities or groups of people that are for whatever reason relegated to kind of the peripheries of a perceived center. And the reasons for this are multiple, and they also become, you know, the question of why that is becomes very much part of rewriting these histories. So Sultan was saying, you know, it's not just that we don't know about these women artists, but or that they didn't exist, but it's that, you know, they probably weren't represented by galleries or bought by collectors and or even allowed to study in the same academies as their male peers and so forth. So the question of why becomes really interesting, and it kind of, you know, all really, you know, if we're being very simple, boils down to the existence of particular power structures and how those structures operate. And I think that if we speak about kind of rethinking these structures in order to create a more inclusive model, then several efforts have to happen in parallel, right? It's not only about showing more women in the museum, but also speaking about other things that, you know, that concern women, like maternity laws and pay gaps and education models and different things like that, because otherwise you're sort of just treating a symptom. But having said that, I think there's a lot of value in starting where we are and beginning to do the work, and including in the museum context, right? So this exhibition at the Sharjah Art Museum that Sultan referred to, you know, this is when we decided more than anything to kind of give some acceleration to this conversation about representation of women, and not just, again, it's not just about showing them in the museum, but also asking the broader question as to why they were excluded previously and what kind of changes, what kind of broader changes can we, you know, implement in order to make this kind of effect more sustainable, right? So of course, you know, because this is a new thing we're trying out, right? Whenever you're rethinking a model, you might very well know what you don't want and what doesn't work, but you don't necessarily always have a very clear picture of what will work. And so a lot of it is hinged on experimentation and trial and error. And as Sultan said, you know, in the beginning, we were met with a lot of skepticism from, you know, a lot of our peers in the art community and the academic community to this idea of creating a gender balanced display. And some of them, you know, were quite valid reasons, you know, one being that, you know, the question of quality, as Sultan mentioned, you know, are we going to sacrifice a good work by a male artist in favor of just a mediocre one by a female artist, right? So, and it's a legitimate question, it's a legitimate concern, and something we definitely had to think through as we were putting these exhibitions together. Another one, of course, again, as I mentioned, you know, about this idea of just treating a symptom, are we just tokenizing these women and creating a symbolic display? But at the same time, you know, I go back to this idea of doing several things in parallel. So it's not just about putting them on display, but also doing the diligent research and also rethinking acquisition tactics moving forward, and, you know, how we're changing not just the exhibition at the museum, but also the collection itself. And trying to make it more representative of different groups of people, not just men and women, but, you know, minorities and so forth. So, you know, it's a long process, but I think one does have to start somewhere and put in the work and the time.
If I can just add one last thing to what Suhaila said, is because we're a small foundation and we have this agility that we can take a decision like from now on, we're only showing 50-50% male, female, and do it immediately. So we're not like a bureaucratic museum or a large institution that takes decades, sometimes even years to make a choice. So if you go to many Western museums, you see that the display is 80% male, 20% female at best. And this is at best. Sometimes it's single digits. But when we did it, it was literally within weeks. And we said, why wait? We can just leapfrog this whole bureaucracy and start showing quality works by women artists in parity once again with their male peers.
Oh, that's incredible. So like sticking to this idea of identity. So Hala, you touched on when you first started putting this together, you were looking at the role of abstraction and how it fits into the Arab world. So how do you think artists use, if they do so, how they use abstraction to portray these different identities?
Yeah, you know, the moment itself that we're looking at in this exhibition, the 50s to the 80s, is a moment when identity was at the forefront of a lot of these artists' work, right? National identity was being explored, not just in the arts, but also in other fields like literature and music. This was, you know, of course, a moment of decolonization, when a lot of these countries were becoming independent nation states and changing governments and changing policy, and also beginning to ask themselves, you know, after all of these years of colonization, you know, when we were told sort of who we are, how do we now go back to defining ourselves? And what histories do we mine for that? And how do we write this narrative for ourselves? And so, in some ways, abstract art, not only abstract art, but, you know, abstract art included, was a useful vehicle for the questioning of these concepts. So some of these artists, they went back to their Islamic and pre-Islamic histories, looking at things like architectural patterns and geometric patterns and textiles and metalware and even body tattoos and pre-Islamic histories in the sense of, you know, say pharaonic artifacts or Mesopotamian objects, and then drawing on those formal languages, on those histories, traditions, to formulate a new language for the expression of a national identity. And, you know, for many of these artists, of course, going back kind of to their pre-colonial past served a way of creating more unifying tactics. So for instance, a pharaonic history, something that all Egyptians across, you know, ethnic, religious, sectarian divide still identified with. And so if that is the language you use to formulate a national identity, it is more likely to be a unifying one. Of course, you know, again, these histories were very layered and complex, so things didn't only happen in one way, and a lot of the times artists who were indeed working on and questioning national identities were not necessarily working alongside the government, right? So again, here you sometimes have diverging visions of what a national art can be or a national visual language can be. And yeah, I mean, I would say that abstract art, or, you know, I kind of feel almost hesitant to use the word abstract here or abstraction, because a lot of the times these artists didn't even identify their work as quote unquote abstract. But let's say non-objective, non-representational work was only one way of doing that.
And Sultan, from your point of view, obviously abstraction is a global phenomenon. How did abstraction come into the conversation when you were trying to collect art from this part of the world?
I didn't think I was buying abstract art. So the word abstract didn't even come to my mind. I thought this is a pretty work. It looks interesting. And I bought it if I could afford it. And in many cases, especially in the earlier years, yes, it was easier to buy works because there wasn't that much interest. Unlike now, where sometimes the works become so expensive that I ask about an artwork, I come back to it 5 years later, it's still available, and I say, well, maybe you should reconsider the price that you're asking for. And so I never went out thinking, let me build an abstract art collection. In fact, the first time I actually thought about, hold on a second, what do we have that's abstract, was in 2017, when I was at the Kevorkian and I met with Lynn Gumpert, as Suhaila told you earlier, and she said, well, we're thinking about doing an abstract show. And I said, well, interesting, we do have some of these. I wonder if this work would qualify as abstract. And to be honest with you, there are works today in Taking Shape that I never thought about in terms of abstraction. The works that showed calligraphy, I never thought this calligraphy is an abstraction. For me, calligraphy is calligraphy. It's not abstract. But when you look at it, it is shapes, right? It's a coming together of different shapes. And so all these things for me were a learning process, and now abstraction is definitely present in the back of my mind when I look at the work and I say, I wonder if this could be an abstract artwork or not. And there were very few artists who actually thought out the process of creating an abstract artwork, who actually sometimes wrote about this process, like Selwa Rawda Shukair of Lebanon. She actually theorized it in the 1940s and said, this is what I think is abstract art. But many other artists stumbled upon abstraction. Many of them were depicting things that I don't think they would say this is an abstract artwork in the 1950s and 60s. But you look at it today, and yes, it does qualify as being abstract. And as a collector, I think my taste has changed and my interest have changed over the past two decades. Initially, I was buying works that were more contemporary, 21st century, and I realized later, after many years, that I'm more interested in the mid-20th century. As a collector, I was I was exposed to work by male artists. And so when I looked at the collection, I'm like, wow, this is like, it's two-thirds male, one-third female, or even more. And so now it's much more gender balanced. So it's a learning process that I have gone through personally. And the last thing I will say is I feel like I have a responsibility towards the general public, because this is a public-facing collection and not a private-facing collection. It's not a collection I'd be hanging at home, but this is something that is going to be displayed to the public. Children, little boys and little girls and students and the parents and grandparents will come and visit. And so you have a responsibility to the society to showcase work that is equally representative of the society, that is fair and just. You have a responsibility not to allow commercial values come into consideration. You have a responsibility where you're not trying to promote an artist that you met and you found him or her to be very nice, and you say, well, how about we show more of their work because they're such a nice, you know, they're such a nice person. And make sure that this collection is good for the people. It's good for the public. They go and they learn, and they go and they educate themselves. So that's a long-winded way of saying that it's a work in progress.
So Sultan, going off of that, Taking Shape is obviously from 1950s to 1980s. But do you think there are any recurring themes between the pieces in this collection and sort of more recent events that you referred to as the Arab world, so such as the Arab Spring or other uprisings? Is this work relevant today as well?
I think Suhaila touched upon this earlier, where these decades are the decades of the formation of national identity. And some artists decided that they would explore this formation of national identity through figurative art, through sculpture, through painting a certain leader. But some artists said, well, we need to go deeper and think about what art is for us. You know, we think about our own traditions, like Sufism. We try and draw inspiration from our own history. And so I feel like these themes have never left this region, especially countries that were colonized and denied the right to education and denied the right to self-expression for decades or even centuries. So this is a work in progress once again, that whether it's in the 1950s or the 19-teens, that these regions have not been able to yet overthrow the yoke of colonialism. It really takes a long time to decouple yourself from a country that has colonized another country for decades, where your grandparents' only language is probably French, and where your grandfather or grandmother was denied an education because they came from the long political background. So this is a process that we've never been able to overthrow, and it's actually very interesting because people find expression in different ways to work around it. And yes, I think that there definitely is some overlap, especially when you look at graffiti artists of the 21st century, how they once again go back to similar themes that you saw of the 1950s and 60s.
And Suhaila, do you think that sort of current events shape your curation process?
I mean, in some ways, yes. Especially when we're working with contemporary art, right? Then it becomes truly relevant. When we're more steeped in works from the 20th century, of course, historical research and sort of looking at the looking back and retrospective research then comes to the foreground a little more. But, you know, just kind of to jump back to the previous question that Sultan was just discussing, you know, I always find this such a fascinating thing to think about, you know, not just between the 20th and the 21st centuries, like how does modern art impact the more recent and, you know, contemporary artists, but also the continuities or the possible continuities between Islamic art and modern art, right? are they actually there? I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there was a continuity of, you know, can we really build a coherent genealogy of how one thing morphed into the next and then the next? Or was there indeed a rupture? And then, you know, and then artists would look back at histories and reinvent them, which is kind of what my sense is, not only between the Islamic and the modern, but also in some ways between the modern and the contemporary. It's definitely something that merits much deeper and more rigorous research. But definitely, you know, as Sultan was saying, the presence of colonialism in that time did interrupt, I would say, a natural progression of, you know, of a genealogy of a visual language or a style or a technique or so forth. So definitely there are some discrepancies.
So to wrap up, this is to both of you. Do you see the Burjeel Art Foundation as having an active role in social activism and justice in the region?
Wow, that's such a loaded question, and I actually like it. I think the answer is you can't but be doing that today. In the 21st century, you can't but be for social justice. There's so many causes, not only in the Arab world, but throughout the world that we all identify with, whether it's women's rights, whether it's human rights, whether it's freedom of expression, whether it is minority representation. There's just so much that we all stand for, I think, that there's very few people who would say I'm against human rights. But and so the mere existence of this foundation that is dedicated to promoting art from an overlooked group of individuals, I think is already a political statement, that it is already a way to deny those who want to continue to overlook this region the ability to do so. And so I remember even 15 years ago, talking to curators and saying, how come you're not showing art from this region? And they say, well, we can't find resources. I say, well, I'll send you resources. I'll connect you to people. I'll connect you to collectors. Here are some books. I'll email you some PDFs. What is your excuse? Why are you not showing this art? And so you kind of find them retreating into a corner. And then slowly they start saying, well, okay, well, I'll agree and I would like to learn more about this region. And in one instance, there was an exhibition in a museum. This is many, many years ago. And they were doing a show on global modernism in the 1960s, and they were going to not include a single work from this region. And so when they reached out to me, I connected them to other collectors, not just myself. And they ended up showing several works from this region. So I think we have become a node or a central hub, not only for our collection, but we really try to connect other people. So yes, we are for social activism. We are for all the things you mentioned. And I think that today we have a choice of either standing on the side or being an active participant in the rewriting of this history and rewriting it for the future. And so I really believe that in all modesty that we're playing a very small but crucial role.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, especially about kind of being a node in this larger field of global modernism. And I hope that our work does begin to fill a certain gap. And I think when I look at the collection and the work of the foundation, the kind of responsibility or social responsibility that I see is not necessarily in telling stories or creating narratives, because it's not really something I believe we can do. But I think where the responsibility lies is in being a channel for as many voices as possible. And that is about expanding the collection to different groups of people, to different regions, again, to men and women, right? So if we can become a platform where those stories can be voiced, then I think that that is a success already. So I don't think we can write kind of prescriptive narratives, but if we can just provide a space for others to speak and for the artworks to speak, for histories to, different strands of histories to be presented to the public eye and to the academic eye as well, I think that that is probably what I see as our responsibility being.
That's great. So thank you so much, Sultan and Sohaila, for being here with us today. We're so excited to have Taking Shape at the McMullen, and we're really looking forward to seeing Burjeel Foundation grow and, yeah, see the future of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That concludes this episode of Art in Focus. Thank you for listening, and be sure to visit The Terrace, the McMullen Student Publications page to find more episodes in the series. This episode was produced by Rachel Brody, the McMullen Graduate Assistant and a doctoral candidate in the History Department. It was mixed and edited by Nisha Momin and Megan Minahan, and thanks to Rachel Chamberlain, the McMullen Manager of Education. Finally, thank you to our digital team, Arvind Mohapatra and Alex Hall, who uploaded these episodes onto the Terrace.